Enough water, just enough wine, just enough crumbs, a dollar and a dime, just enough hope to keep us toeing the line. But sooner or later,
that marvelous song is Sooner or Later. That's by Eliza Gilkinson, and we use it as the introduction to Activist Radio, where we offer a little history you didn't learn in high school. We have at least three news stories you haven't seen in the New York Times, and we end up with music to help you join the resistance. Activist Radio can be heard Thursdays, 5 to 6 p.m. on WVKR 91.3 FM at Vassar College in Poughkeepsie, New York. Thursdays from 7 to 8 p.m. on WBDY, and that's 99.5 FM at the Bundy in Binghamton, New York. Sundays, 1:30 to 2:30 p.m. on WESU, and that's 88.1 FM at Wesleyan University in Middletown, Connecticut. Sundays 4 to 5 p.m. from the WIOF, and that's 104.1 FM in Woodstock, New York. And Sundays 5 to 6 p.m. from the Progressive Radio Network, and they're at prn.live, prn.live. Past programs are available as a podcast. Search for Activist Radio on, well, iTunes, Google Play, Digital Podcast. There's no end of places to sign up for Activist Radio as a podcast, but you can also listen to us anytime on the web at classwars.org. Our last 10 programs are right there. Our guest today is going to be Ahmad Abuzaid. He's a co-founder of the Dream Defenders. He's the executive director of the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights. And we talk today about the links between Black Lives Matter and the fight for justice in Palestine. This brings me, of course, to the views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station, its board of directors, or its constituents. It's just the views of me today, Fred, and I'm bringing you up to date on America's hidden class wars.
In a moment of glory coming after you die, but you know damn well it's a lie. Take the food from the hungry, medication from the poor. Take the children from their mothers, we can't take it anymore. Cause
be louder than your screams. The people's day will come. Emma Goldman, I sang this song for you. Big Bill Haywood and Mother Jones too. Psycho and Vanzetti, they took your lives. But we can organize. will be louder than your screams.
That's The People's Day by Otis Gibbs. We use it as, of course, the introduction of the first part of Activist Radio. It's a part that we look at history we didn't learn in our media, in our college courses, in high school, in fact. It's often left out as part of our history of social struggle. We are taught that social change comes from the voting box, that politicians in Washington choose our direction. But in fact, so much of American history is based on social struggle, and certainly the successes are always laid to that rather than some politician deciding somewhere what to do and then getting enough people to vote for him. Social struggle is something that goes on irrespective of campaigns and politicians. We're going to go now in history back to November 24th, 1541. And that was the day that Spanish explorer Vasquez de Coronado and 1,500 of his men held the first Thanksgiving celebration in Palo Duro Canyon, located in modern-day Texas. French Huguenot colonists celebrated a Thanksgiving in 1564, near what is now Jacksonville, Florida. But we all know Thanksgiving from what happened in 1621, when Plymouth colonists celebrated the fall harvest with the local Wampanoag people. And in 1789, George Washington called for a national day of Thanksgiving and prayer to be held on November 26th. Sarah Hale, then an editor of a magazine called Ladies Magazine, that was 1827, wrote editorials and sent letters urging the holiday be made permanent. After decades of pressure on lawmakers, President Abraham Lincoln declared that the last Thursday in November would forever be Thanksgiving, and that was in 1863. In 1876, the American Intercollegiate Football Association began to hold championship games on the national holiday, and Macy's Parade was held the first time in 1924. Thanksgiving certainly has a long history, especially in the good old USA. So pass me a piece of that lemon meringue pie, would you? So now you probably expect me to say something negative about our grand old holiday, our excuse to come together to get to know all our relatives again. But like the Macy's Day Parade, there are hidden aspects to all this good cheer. Vasquez de Coronado was leading a military invasion. He had 400 European men-at-arms and almost 2,000 Mexican Indian elites. It was an army. And he also had a contingent of African slaves. His army destroyed many indigenous cities looking for the gold that just wasn't there. Of course, the story of the Plymouth colonists is even better known. In a few short years, the Wampanoag would be gone, along with so many other indigenous peoples. The European colonists just kept coming, creating, militarizing more and more settlements. When the native peoples fought back, like during the King Philip's War, they disappeared even faster. There was no sharing of this land of opportunity after the first Thanksgiving celebration for working together. George Washington liked the idea of a national holiday, only he didn't include the people of the Iroquois Nation. Fed up with the Iroquois' support of the British, he sent an army for what he called the total destruction and devastation of all their towns and villages. In fact, the Iroquois called Washington, quote, the town destroyer. That was their name for him. And they named him aptly for his genocidal policies towards indigenous people. Abraham Lincoln declared Thanksgiving a national holiday and even held a Thanksgiving celebration. But it was during the Civil War, when half the nation refused to free their 3.5 million black slaves. By that time, the U.S. had become the largest slaveholding nation in the world. Perhaps we can celebrate our good intentions without being ignorant of our history of colonization and oppression. Hidden from us, our history of conquest will always be there to lead us in the wrong direction, towards racism and wars of aggression. Let our good intentions bring an end to America's senseless wars abroad. Let our spirit of goodwill reverse the U.S. backed assaults on the people of Yemen and Palestine. Let us envision what our country could be, a beacon of liberty, equality, and peace in an oppressed world. Now that would be worth celebrating. We're going to go to a song now by Roger Waters. It's a celebratory song, actually. A marvelous rendition of We Shall Overcome. And Roger has just finished his U.S. tour, where in part he was promoting Vets for Peace. Quite amazing. And calling for the withdrawal of U.S. from Ukraine and NATO. So, quite an eye-opening tour that he has just done, Roger Waters. Let's hear We Shall Overcome.
That we'll work hand. set us free. The truth will set us free. Truth will set us all free. On that day,
they lied, they lied, they took us for a ride, tried burying the truth where it very nearly died. They lied, but no matter what they tried to hide, sing and shout, the truth wins out, everybody knows they lied. I ain't telling you nothing you don't already know, but the government's...
And that's a little bit of They Lied, that's Jay Mankita. We use it as the lead into the next part of Activist Radio. It has its own website, fantasylandmedia.org. The website is keyword searchable, of course, has stories going back a decade. You can research how the New York Times covered specific issues, you know, all the way back 10, 12 years. We think it's an in-depth look at what we think are the failings of our corporate-controlled media. All the news is made by the people in charge, and we know who those people are. The corporations, the CEOs, the billionaires, and your very own government. Cover your tracks, cause you're paying for it all with your federal tax. Our first story today is from Common Dreams, the New York Times, and a new climate denialism. The headlines of the interactive New York Times opinion piece by conservative columnist Brett Stevens is placed over an image of Greenland's melting ice cap, crashing into the slushy meltwater below. With one more scroll, the word "but" appears over the ice, which by then resembles a melting slush pile in a parking lot. From just a glance at the headline, it was clear where this article was going. The 6,000-word piece went on to chronicle Stephen's trip to Greenland as a self-proclaimed global warming agnostic. There, the dramatic effects of climate change, quote, changed his mind about the problem, but reinforced his, quote, belief that markets, not government, provide the cure. Stephen's point of view represents a new climate denialism. No longer can any rational person claim that climate change isn't happening at an accelerated rate due to human causes, or that it's not causing harm. Instead, they argue, like Stephen's, that the swift, decisive action scientists say is necessary is magical thinking, and that the genuine existential fear is alarmist, and that most humans will be able to adapt to climate disaster. Well, the New York Times doesn't mind talking about climate disaster as long as the solution doesn't threaten the profits of huge multinational companies. But isn't it the major corporations that have led us to this incipient disaster? Could our newspaper of record really believe that big oil will eventually save us? The second story is from FAIR, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting. Action alert! New York Times invents left extremists to make moderation the midterm winner. Of the many lessons to be learned from this year's midterm, in which Democrats defied historical trends to largely hold off a GOP wave, the New York Times' Jonathan Weissman and Kate Kluick singled out corporate media's recurring favorite, that moderation won. But in true Timesian fashion, Weissman and Kluick argued that the voters rejected both extremes. On the right and on the left, people voted to Reject Extremists in Midterms, announced the headline to their piece in the print edition. While most would accept that some GOP candidates had extremist positions, the reporters matched those on the left with mere labels. From the liberal wing of their party was one label, an ardent progressive was another label, and not a single policy position or statement of action. Apparently, if you call a politician progressive at the New York Times, it's meant to be understood that they're extreme. No further explanation is required. Well, the New York Times is the establishment's filter to keep progressive ideas out of the mainstream. However elections turn out, the New York Times will see the results as repudiating leftist candidates. And when progressive candidates get too popular, why, they're just left out of the coverage altogether, like the Bernie blackout of the last several years. Our third story is from Common Dreams. Quote, huge methane leak in Pennsylvania sparks fresh call for fracking ban. A leak that erupted a methane storage facility in western Pennsylvania on November 6 spewed massive amounts of the highly potent greenhouse gas for a week and a half, reigniting demands on Friday to better regulate and eventually euthanize the fracking industry as part of a crucial transition from fossil fuels to clean energy. At Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, the paper reported Thursday morning that the venting was finally stopped. Quote, a natural gas storage well in Cambria County has been leaking gas for 10 days, blanketing the mountains in Jackson Township with a roar like a jet engine and its valleys with an odor of hydrocarbons, unquote. So-called natural gas is primarily made of methane, a potent greenhouse gas that traps roughly 80 times as much heat as carbon dioxide over the first 20 years after it reaches the atmosphere. And it's also responsible for almost half of the 1.2 Celsius increase in average surface temperatures since the Industrial Revolution. Despite the clear case for moving more quickly towards green energy, President Joe Biden has yet to use his executive authority to cancel nearly two dozen frac gas export projects that are set to unleash pollution equivalent to roughly 400 new coal-powered plants. It's a disturbing news item about the leak, the methane leak. But our major media, and that's easy to tell, that you can do a news search on parts of the principal story. So a quick look indicated the New York Times had not covered the story, but also very few major publications in the U.S. covered the story as well. So I would say that the New York Times has always been a fan of catastrophic energy sources. The newspaper has always had a preference for example, nuclear energy and frack gas, because that's where the big money is, of course. And as long as the New York Times protects such dangerous energy solutions, we will continue to get hotter, colder, wetter, drier. The Dust Bowl of the 1930s was nothing compared to the migrations that will follow. Well, we have just about time to, before we introduce the song, to talk a little bit about our guest. And our guest is Ahmed Abouzeid. And we had a wide-ranging talk about the campaign for Palestinian rights and how it relates to so many human rights organizations fighting for justice, both in the U.S. and abroad. But before we get to that, we're going to go now to a song. And this song is pretty interesting because it was parts of the song are from the anti-NATO demonstrations in Chicago that occurred maybe 5 or 6 years ago. Actually, I went to them. The song is by Mistahi, and the song itself is called No to NATO. Let's listen to that song.
I spent 10 years in the United States Army as a combat medic. I deployed to Baghdad in 2004. I'm here to return my Global War on Terrorism Service Medal in solidarity with the people of Iraq and the people of Afghanistan. I am deeply sorry for the destruction that we have caused in those countries and around the globe. These were lies. I'm giving them back.
Imperialism, and this is dedicated to all the courageous people who are under attack by the FBI.
All right, that was a really interesting song, a great song by Miss Dahi. No to NATO, and as you heard in the background, a lot of it was filmed at the Chicago anti-NATO demonstration, which is a fascinating mixture of people, quite large in fact, and we all went and watched GIs throw their medals behind them on the stage and talk about why they were rejecting what they had done in Iraq and Afghanistan. All right, we're going to go to now Ahmad Abuzneid, and co-founder of Dream Defenders. Actually, before he became executive director of the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights, And we talked today about how words bring groups together. It's the vocabulary. It's the word occupation, for example, and racism and human rights. And when you start talking about that for African Americans in the U.S., we see the same words being used when we talk about the Palestinian occupation, isn't it? The might and the violence directed at people because of their race or ethnicity or their religion. So the two really are very similar. And we talk also about being PEP, progressive except for Palestine. So how can you talk about human rights and not care about what Israel is doing to its 5 million Palestinian people? So let's go to this interview that was done last week.
All right. Ahmad Abu Znaid, U.S. Executive Director for the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights. Thank you so much for being on Activist Radio today.
Hey, thanks for having me, Fred.
You're a person that's going to know the story of Summer Lee. The election is just over and she was able to win. But for people who don't know who Summer Lee is, what made her run for Congress unusual and very important if you believe in, you know, human rights?
Yeah, that's a great way to start off the conversation today. Because as the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights, we view Palestinian rights as firmly situated within the progressive movement in the United States of America. And Summer Lee is a young, bright social justice advocate turned member of Congress. And not only is she progressive on domestic issues, but Summer Lee is also an advocate for Palestinian rights. And that actually made Summer Lee a target of our opposition. So the pro-Israel lobby that, you know, is one of the more powerful lobbies in U.S. politics, you know, they put millions of dollars through AIPAC and DMFI, the Democratic Majority for Israel. So through these different institutions, they funneled millions of dollars into the race to attempt to beat out Summer Lee. But we're thankful that, you know, they failed, and we're hopeful that this is a representative of an environment politically that's going to be much more friendly to those advocates in the future. That's what we're really excited about, that the squad doesn't just remain four or five, that every single election we add on to that until we see a Congress that's really representative of a just solution for Palestinians.
Well, AIPAC certainly has a track record of destroying candidates, doesn't it? I mean, going back Cynthia McKinney, all the way back to the early 2000s, knocked off her. How did they do it? I guess they poured money into the person opposing her for the nomination. Well, she was from Georgia, I think. So they have a long track record, which I think makes it really difficult to talk to certainly candidates about Palestine. They'll tell you, well, we're for Palestinian rights, but, you know, we can't really talk about it right now. So it's a difficult thing for local groups to do, to talk about Palestinian rights. She made such a great quote that I'm just going to have to read it now. You know this quote. This is Summer Lee. But as we fight against injustice here and in the movement for Black lives, we must stand against injustice everywhere. Inhumanities against Palestinian people cannot be tolerated or justified. So it's amazing that a statement like that would make her such a target. But boy, she was. Mm-hmm. How did she win?
You know, I think what we're seeing is in this moment, you know, the data will tell as we get further away from Election Day. But, you know, what I'm seeing is that young people showed up in full force. And this young generation isn't beholden to some of those old status quo political frameworks that, you know, politicians have been fed over the decades. So I don't think that the average Gen Z voter cares about, you know, the shared values between the U.S. and the state of Israel. I don't think that folks of that mindset, you know, necessarily care about, you know, continuing wars and continuing U.S. imperialism. I would say, you know, going a step further, not only do they not care about continuing that, but I think what we're seeing of this young generation is a care and a yearning for a world that, you know, deserves better and that can be better. So I think that these folks are looking at their counterparts in Palestine or in Iraq or in Afghanistan or in Iran, in many places, and thinking, you know, U.S. foreign policy has to be much better, right? I mean, even if this current situation with Iran, it just shows that the U.S. government having no relationship whatsoever, it shows an inability with which, you know, for us to act in a intentional manner. All we do is sanction the countries that, you know, we don't support. But then, you know, I think you'll see U.S. politicians now paying lip service to Iranian civilians when those are the folks who have been impacted by all of these sanctions over the years. So I think this younger generation rejects that, and that's what I'm hoping that we're going to see from Summer Lee and on. Yeah.
I'm seeing also a real resentment against AIPAC defining what a Jew is. And our groups, both the local groups, Mideast Crisis Response and JVP, have many Jewish members. And I think the members want to pronounce what Judaism is, and they reject the fact that Judaism is linked to an apartheid state, essentially. Was there a lot of Jewish support for Summer Lee?
You know, I have to track that data, Fred. I'm not sure. But I think you're onto something when you talked about, you know, folks being frustrated. I think this is a moment where even these situations revolving Kanye West and Kyrie Irving, you've seen the ADL take such a prominent role in watching these situations play out, or driving how these situations play out. And I think this is another moment where we're not only are we learning about the nefarious objectives of AIPAC, but the nefarious objectives of the ADL. You know, I think they could have dealt with some of these dynamics, particularly the one with Kyrie Irving. I think they could have dealt with it in a much more diplomatic way that wasn't going to push away the Black community. And I think, like, you know, many of us who are involved in these social justice groups and movements, we know, of course, of the historic relationship that existed between Jews and Blacks in the civil rights movement here in the United States. But organizations like the ADL and, you know, silencing critique of Israel and targeting of anyone who steps out of line, of course, you know, pushes these communities away. And so the ADL, I hope, will continue to be shown to be a farce and continue to be shown to be a fraud in the fight against anti-Semitism. And you know, hopefully folks will recognize that they're really just a defender of Zionism.
Is this support, huge financial support of, you know, conservative anti-Palestinian candidates, is that pushing AIPAC to be more conservative itself? And I ask the question because at some points AIPAC seems to be talking to the very people who are the most anti-Semitic. I mean, who have also a track record of anti-Semitic comments, but AIPAC, you know, doesn't seem to mind talking to those people. So I'm wondering, is AIPAC going to the right?
Yeah. Well, you know, I think AIPAC probably was always there, but I think a couple of factors. One, I think we've seen historically that evangelicals, at times Christian evangelicals who espouse anti-Semitism, are amongst the biggest backers of Zionism in the U.S. And so that has remained unchanged. I think, you know, also what's happening here is that we're seeing just a very small vocal minority within the Democrats, you know, pretty much the Squad Plus, that are really critiquing Israel. Everyone else is actually marching with the status quo and the mainstream. But what happens is sometimes the opposition does the work for us. And I think what we've seen is because of wanting to maintain relationships with the right, because of the way a vocal minority within the Democratic Party has spoken out against AIPAC, I'm wondering if AIPAC's strategy also switched to saying, we're going to invest more in the Republican side. We're going to advocate more in the Republican circles. We're going to recruit more in the Republican circles, because maybe they see what's happening with the Democratic Party as really, you know, as a barometer of what's to come. And I think that's what we believe, right? We believe that on the left, you know, we're chipping away, we're building, we're expanding that tent more and more. And eventually we feel like, you know, there's no vehicle right now for us to get, you know, some form of support within the Republican Party. But it feels like on the Democratic side, again, we have the squad, you know, which is slowly growing. And those folks, you know, tend to take up positions that are, you know, at least mindful and thoughtful of the Palestinian position.
It'll be interesting to see how much this story of Summer Lee is covered in the New York Times. I mean, it's a big story. It's very condemning of AIPAC, I think, and other conservative Zionist groups. But in the past, the media hasn't really wanted to touch these items too much either, right? Do you still see the media as not really wanting to get involved with Zionist causes? Or let's say...
Yeah, I mean, I think more... I was going to say more so than the elections. I think, you know, I've been, you know, disappointed with the lack of media coverage of what's been happening on the ground lately. I mean, you know, it's certainly not as violent and as intense as it was last year during the May and June uprisings. But I mean, what we've seen in the last few weeks is a really intensified brutalization of the Palestinian people, particularly young people. We've seen a lot of young martyrs on the Palestinian side. And so I've actually been really disappointed to see a lack of that coverage. Now, you know, I think as it relates to domestic coverage of the elections, I think that, you know, continues to be, as you mentioned, more of the same. But I do think it's a conversation that those of us in the Palestine movement are ready to continue to push forward. One of the examples, for instance, is young Maxwell Frost. Maxwell Frost was a Gen Z. I think he's the youngest member ever elected to Congress, and he's a Gen Z representative out of Florida. And this young man is, you know, an activist turned member of Congress and, you know, kind of has a lot of domestic progressive values and positions. But what happened was he backtracked and threw the Palestinian movement in Central Florida under the bus. And so here, I think, is a challenge for us as a movement is, you know, how do we respond to these folks that are, you know, progressive on domestic values, that are, you know, looking for gun legislation, looking for, you know, a route to citizenship for undocumented immigrants. I mean, they're taking all these other positions that, again, most of us in the progressive movement support, but he's leaving out Palestine. And I think that's going to be the challenge for us, is not only how do we make sure we continue to get these Summer Lee types elected, but how do we deal with these folks that are continue to be PEPs, right? Progressive except for Palestine.
Progressive except for Palestine, right? And that's been Congress over the last 30 or 40 years. You know, candidates really very fearful. As a matter of fact, I think it was maybe 15 years ago we met with a member of Congress. We met actually with his aide and talking about Palestine. And the aide said, you know, we're scared of AIPAC. You know, they have crazy people involved. They have millions of dollars. You know, we try to support Palestinian rights when we can, but, you know, they really have, they have a hold over at least the House of Representatives. So it was an interesting insight.
It's a machine.
Yeah,
it's a machine. And then I think President Obama, I haven't read the book, but from what I understand, he discussed it in his latest book release, maybe even had a whole chapter dedicated to the fact that that was the most frustrating, you know, lobby or you know, essentially, you know, grouping of folks for him to deal with.
Yeah.
You know, even before he thought, if he even thought, he felt like if he thought about making a statement about settlements, that he would get, you know, hundreds of calls. I mean, that was how much it seemed like via his text that he was traumatized by that lobby. So you're spot on that, you know, it's something that they've been building and building and building for decades. And, you know, it's a powerful machine.
Sure. You spent, a part of your youth in Palestine. I was reading that you were born in Palestine, right? And then you came back at 7. And I was wondering how that perception, many of us, you know, we know Israel, Palestine from what we read, but as a child, did that give you a different insight into the occupation?
Yeah, absolutely. So I was born in Jerusalem, but my family's from Al-Khalil, a.k.a. Hebron. And I lived a bit of my childhood in both, primarily from the ages 7 to 12, because when I was 1 year old, we left from Palestine and lived in the U.S. So, yeah, I think when you live in the U.S. and you know, we lived a relatively comfortable life. We were, like, I would say, you know, a lower middle class family. But, you know, I went to public school in South Florida. I, you know, went to the skating ring with my friends on the weekends. There was, like, little things you could do as a 6 or 7 year old kid that were really cool. And then you then transition to living under occupation. And I mean, there couldn't have been a more drastic shift for me as a 7 year old than my first day landing. In those days, myself and my mother were allowed to fly into Ben Gurion Airport. Of course, we're no longer allowed to do that because we have Palestinian IDs. So we stopped doing that a while ago. But in this experience, I was 7 years old flying into Tel Aviv with my mother. I was told that I was going to be visiting my homeland and my family, and my father was there waiting on us, and it was this anticipation built up. But as soon as we got off of the plane, we had to go through the separate line that Palestinians need to go through. And not only did they question us, but they took us to a back room and strip searched us. And so that was my first few hours living under occupation as a 7-year-old. So those first few hours stuck with me till this day, of standing next to my mother as a 7-year-old in our underwear while they're going ruffling through all of our luggage. And of course, the next 5 years I lived over there had several other, you know, I had several other experiences that stood out. When the Ibrahimi Mosque massacre occurred, I was living in Hebron, about 10 to 15 minute drive from the mosque. When this settler from Brooklyn, New York, you know, decided to become a mass murderer of Palestinians. And when Jesse Jackson visited, I was there with my father who helped organize his delegation. And we got shot at with tear gas canisters. There's several memories that, you know, whether it's the checkpoints day to day going to school or the curfew that was enacted by the Israelis after the Ibrahimi Mosque massacre. I mean, you know, these were really vivid memories for me as a 7 to 12 year old that I'll never forget. So absolutely. I came back to the U.S. with a mindset of, you know, we got to do something about these injustices, not just there, but here as well.
Sure. We have just a couple more minutes, and actually I have a bunch of questions I wanted to ask you. I wanted to cover Mondo Weiss, extremely good source of information from Israel, Palestine. And I think you've done an interview with Mondo Weiss, their radio station, right? Where do groups like Mondo Weiss fit in Palestinian human rights?
Well, I think, you know, content creation, being able to educate folks, being able to shift the conversation is huge for us as a movement. And so Mondo Weiss is a part of that collective effort that I think you see from, like, the IMEU, the Journal of Palestine Studies, you know, several other, you know, outfits that are really attempting to create content, written, video, you name it, so that we can continue to shift the conversation around Palestine.
Sure.
So huge supporter of Mondo Weiss.
Yeah. I'm going to put a link to Mondo Weiss when this program airs, so people can go. It's pretty local, you know. It's the creation, I think, is done in Cold Spring, which is right on the Hudson down the river.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah, so people around here, the mid Hudson River area would be interested in that too. We just have time to talk about the rooting resistance campaign for planting trees. That's another campaign that you're involved with. What does that involve, resisting through planting?
Yeah, so I mean, anyone who knows the Palestinian story, the Palestinian people, or even Palestinian cuisine knows how important olive oil, olives, and olive trees are to our culture. I mean, they've sustained us over hundreds of years. And in fact, every single Palestinian family who still has a relationship to the ground can tell you about their experiences as a child, you know, going to collect the olives with their family, taking to the olive press, creating the oil. And so what we've done at the U.S. Campaign for Palestinian Rights is we've partnered with the Palestine Fair Trade Association to plant over 25,000 olive trees across Palestine. This has been since 2010. And the reason is not just because of how important olive trees are, but as noted in across media, the settlers and the Israeli military are really unforgiving to these olive trees. I mean, they uproot them, they burn them, they sabotage olive groves. And so what we're doing is not only through this campaign supporting, you know, farmers to resist in the moment, we're supporting farmers to resist for decades on end, because these trees are going to sustain their families and their communities for years to come. So our goal this year was $90,000. And, you know, I'm really, really proud to say that we raised $86,438.
Wow.
It's a way, again, for us to support the folks on the ground, provide sustenance, and, again, to resist through tying ourselves to the ground. So really excited about this campaign, Fred, and thanks for giving me a moment to talk about it.
Yeah, I'll put a link to that campaign on Class Wars, our website, as well. We have just room for one more question, and I wanted to ask this. It's a sort of a big question, so you don't have to really get so much into it. But, you know, people in the U.S. are talking about fascism. We haven't talked about fascism, you know, since we fought the Germans. And we've been taking a look at, well, the Third Reich, how politicians and German corporations used racism to gain power. And I think the reason we're talking about this is we do have a Republican Party, at least, that is willing to use racial hatreds for power. So my question is that beneficial, do you think, to talk about the fact that the Zionist movement is a fascist movement, both in Israel, and some aspects of this fascist movement harken back to the 1930s, like Kristallnacht. Kristallnacht could happen in the West Bank at any point, you know, I mean, it looks the same. So do you think it's beneficial bringing out these links to fascist movements, or do you think that that's just counterproductive and we should focus on other things?
No, I think it's really important, but I think, like, you know, most folks in this generation, I think we probably got to do a better job educating them on what fascism is and what it looks like, and the the rolling out of fascism, right? It doesn't start in the 1940s in Germany, right? It was the buildup in the 30s, right? You had a people that felt abandoned, and people, you know, very similar to what, you know, white nationalists are kind of espousing here in the U.S. at the time, right? When you saw people in Charlottesville marching saying Jews will not replace us.
Exactly.
This is absolutely a conversation we need to have, Fred. There was a text I just saw someone tweeted on my timeline about a book that's called The Holocaust and the Nakba. Think those sorts of texts and conversations are critical, not just for us as a movement in Palestine, but for those of us in the U.S. who are worried about fascism and what these, you know, even this most recently elected Israeli government with the Kahanis getting elected. I mean, if we're not making this stuff clear for folks, then we're missing an opportunity to educate and galvanize. And I'll say lastly, the Israeli government has been fascist. It's a settler colonial apartheid government. They've been fascist, but I think there's levels and there's layers to it. And so we can't dismiss what's happening now with these Kahanis and Ben-Gavir taking a ministerial position, just like we can't dismiss what happened here with the Trump administration and these folks that have been attempting to get elected, really ever since, I think, President Obama's presidency.
Yeah. Ahmad, thank you so much for being part of Activist Radio today. I do have a bunch of other questions. Maybe we'll do it again sometime. I'd love to.
That would be great. That would be great.
So, and I want to thank you for taking the time and certainly for the work that you do for Palestinian rights. We know that's the work that has to be done. That's the work that's right, isn't it? I mean, so I think we work together to free Palestine. So thank you so much.
I appreciate you, my brother. Thank you, Fred. Have a good one.
Yeah. Bye now.
Activist Radio can be heard Thursdays 5 to 6 p.m. on WVKR 91.3 FM at Vassar College in Poughkeepsie, New York. Sundays 4 to 5 p.m. on WIOF 104.1 FM in Woodstock, New York. And Sundays 5 to 6 p.m. from the Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM. Past shows can be heard on ClassWars.org. Please like our Facebook page, read our ClassWars blog for commentary on today's interview. We'll be here next week at the same time to help you become part of the resistance.